tonight on Arena. Museums, galleries and libraries are open to the public once again, and we preview Amazon Prime's The Underground Railroad, based on the Colson Whitehead novel. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, today saw the country's museums, galleries and libraries open their doors to the public for the first time in months as further easing of COVID-19 restrictions took place. RTE's arts and media correspondent, Sinead Crowley, was there to soak up the atmosphere, and she joins me now. Great day today, Sinead. Where were you, first of all, and what kind of atmosphere was there around the place?
Well, there really was an atmosphere. We started off today at the National Gallery of Ireland, and I was talking to a few people outside. People did queue up to get in. You know, the doors opened at 11. There was loads of people waiting outside. And what really struck me was one woman who said, "I just wanted to look at something different." And I thought, that's it, exactly. We've been walking around our 5K and, you know, maybe looking at the telly or looking at each other, and there was just this sense, I want to go in and look at something. And so in the National Gallery, as with many places, you do have to book in advance, not to pay, but literally just to make sure that they, you know, keep people spaced out and so on. So I suppose my one piece of advice would be, if you're going anywhere over the next few days or weeks, do go online and make sure that there's a, you know, check is there a ticketing system, because they are trying to keep people spaced out. It's also for contact tracing purposes that they'll have your phone number and so on. But a gorgeous atmosphere in the National Gallery. We headed over then to Rathmines Library after lunch, and again we got there at 2. It had opened at 1, and the librarian there told us people had been waiting outside to come in, and it was really busy. They had their books left from before Christmas that they had to give back, and you know, there was, I could really empathise, there was people just kind of just looking at these books as if we're back, you know.
Yeah, there are books on shelves, it's real.
Exactly. And it's not 100%, you can't sit, for example. So she did say a couple of people had asked, could they come in and read their newspaper? Unfortunately not. There's no sitting and studying or sitting and reading yet in the libraries. Yeah. And again, worth checking with your local library, because each one has a different policy depending on staffing and size and everything else. So, for example, in the Dublin City Council area, it's 16 libraries have what they're calling browse and borrow, which means you can actually go in. Mm. The others are operating click and collect. And then around the country, it depends on your local library. It depends on the local authority, what arrangements they've put in place. So check before you go.
Absolutely.
But at the very least, you can click and collect. And they've also, thankfully, got that lovely interlibrary loan system up and running again, which means you can book your book online. It'll come from any library in the country and it'll be delivered to your local one. Super. So that's a lot.
The big thing that you're saying, mentioned it a couple of times there, Sinead, is yes, everything is opening back up, but you really do need to check what exactly the situation is in the particular place you want to go to. Do you have to book? Do you have to have your name down? There won't be charges involved but you do need to do that for safety's sake, because even though things are opening up, we don't want to throw caution to the wind totally. Some heritage sites as well open from this week, Sinead?
Yeah, there are. And again, that's going to be hugely advantageous to people who want to go somewhere else for a walk. You know, the Minister, Catherine Martin, made reference today, of course, to the fact that inter-county travel is opening as well. So not only can you go for a walk, but you can go to another county and see your OPW site. You know, whether it's Bruna Bona or whether it's, you know, whatever, Castletown House, they're all opening either today or over the next couple of days. Again, I suppose check the website, check to where you can go. There'll be some places that have parklands open just for walking around. Other places will have some guided tours in the house. I suspect they'll be very busy and very popular, as people are craving something else to do at the weekends. So check before you go. But it's just a really positive sign, you know, that these things are opening. Obviously wear your mask, use your social distancing, do all that. But there was certainly a sense today that people really want this to be the last day that we do this. You know, I think I've been at the National Gallery twice, if not three times, certainly twice at the reopening day, and we were all hoping that this would be the final reopening day, that this would be it now. Yeah.
And a little bit of consideration goes a long way in these scenarios, and as you say, wearing your mask, keep back from the person in front of you in whatever queue it is. You will get in wherever you want to go. Just think of each other, think of staying safe, even though things are getting better. Let's keep it that way. I heard mention of it on the news there from Ciarán Farthe on the Nuacht, Sinead, about Minister Martin's reference to what might be happening. Nothing definite yet, but some suggestion around theatres and cinemas.
Well, she was very upbeat. Yeah, she said that cinemas and theatres will be back in June. So as we know, when the easing of restrictions was announced, there was a little bit of confusion over was it the 7th of June, was it not? And then there was no specific date. But she certainly said that it is the intention that the cinemas and the theatres be opened in June. She didn't give a definite date, but June. And also, interestingly, she made the point that those people who work in, for example, theatres, actors and so on, are now allowed to go to their workplace. So I know a big problem theatres, for example, have, you know, you can't put on a play with 24 hours notice. You can't be told on a Friday, open on Monday. It's one thing a cinema maybe can, you know, get a film up and running, even though they have to get staff and food and so on. But a play takes a lot of time to rehearse. But she said, no, from today, workers who can't work at home are allowed to travel to their place of work. So if you're a visual artist and that's your studio, you can go. Or if you're an actor, then you can go into a theatre to rehearse. So that should hopefully give theatres time to put shows, you know, to start planning and make plans to put shows on again. So we don't know at this stage, for example, social distancing and so on. We know we don't have those specific rules. We do know that those pilot projects were held before Christmas in the National Concert Hall, for example, where you saw people sitting, you know, far apart from each other and so on. So we don't know the specifics, but we do know that the intention is there to have people back. And then the other news is that it is also her intention to pilot bigger shows, to pilot music shows as well.
These would possibly be outdoor events, and let's hope we get some kind of summer that will make all of that possible. You must be delighted, Sinead, to be actually be reporting on something happening in the arts as opposed to loads of things not happening in the arts.
This is it. The diary is filling up, which is great, because last year it was all about, you know, what isn't happening. And finally, we are getting some rays of light. Now, what's interesting is, and what I suspect will happen for a lot of this year, is you're getting a lot of hybrid events. And you've seen that already with book festivals and so on, where you will have maybe the interviewee and the interviewer in a lovely studio, but yet a lot of the audience will, you know, be watching it online. My suspicion is, even though this is just what I'm surmising, is that even possibly when theatres open back, for example, might you have limited occupancy inside, but a streamed version of the show as well? Could there be two ticketing prices? I suspect that that's the sort of thing. You know, we can't just throw in crammed theatres from the off and expect that to work. So I suspect the idea of hybrid is going to last for a while, but that there will be some audiences back. And then there's this question of pilot shows as well. The minister is talking about piloting outdoor, first of all, later indoor, but first of all, outdoor music events, talking to people like Festival Republic, who are running them in Britain, talking to the Department of Health and the Department of the Taoiseach, and she seems generally committed to getting some sort of a pilot up and running and seeing how it works.
That's as positive a news report as I've heard in certainly this year, Sinead, I think.
Probably the most positive one I've done as well, so we'll go with it.
Let's go with the positivity while it's there. Lovely to speak with you this evening. That's Sinead Crowley, RTE's arts and media correspondent, and obviously, like the rest of us, absolutely delighted that things are opening up and beginning to happen. Bringing us to 12 minutes past 7 on Monday night's Arena. Colson Whitehead's inventive novel about slavery in America, which reimagines the Underground Railroad as literally a network of tunnels and subterranean tracks, has been adapted into a drama series which begins this week on Amazon Prime Video. It's directed by Oscar winner Barry Jenkins, who won for Best Picture for 2016's Moonlight. And Jess Kavanagh has been watching the Underground Railroad and joins me this evening. Maybe just to flesh out that premise, first of all, a little bit more for me, Jess, you know, this idea of, you know, it's an imagined underground actual railroad, but there was a network of people involved who helped slaves get away from the plantation owners.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is very much kind of a marriage between reality and fantasy as well. So you have this kind of adaptation from Whitehead's novel, and it portrays a system of like safe houses, more modes of transport to take black people out of slavery. But he portrays it as an underground railroad. So there's moments with the main character, Cora, where you're very much kind of brought into these dreamscapes and this kind of type of fantasy. And there's moments where it's just extremely real, very visceral and very, very violent. But the journey is very real. She does... I don't know how much I can say, but she ends up on this journey, let's just say. And within that journey, there's moments where we feel that she's getting to this point of safety. But of course, at every step, there's always this danger. There's always this racism. There's always this hostility, depending on where she is. But one of the things I really loved about the series is that each episode is this kind of vignette of different communities that are attempting some semblance of social order, let's just say. And that social order sometimes includes people of colour, black people, and sometimes it doesn't. And the way that that is shown is very, very interesting.
She isn't travelling alone, certainly in the first episode that I saw. She's not travelling alone. She's travelling, Cora, played by Thussu Mbedu, is travelling with Aaron Pierre's character, Caesar. What's the dynamic between the two of them?
It's heartbreaking. There's so many times it's like, Caesar and Cora, there's a beautiful dynamic where, you know, Caesar is this incredibly intelligent black man, and you know he's in this plantation at the beginning, and he's perceived as a buck, is what it's called, which is a kind of a cattle-like term for slaves. He's used for breeding, and so it really really reflects this kind of hypersexualization of black men, and so you know. They end up with this new master, and the new master then decides to take it upon himself to actually watch this breeding occur, and this level of humiliation, I think, is the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak. And you know, he's incredibly intelligent, he's literate, and interestingly enough as well is the book that is references is Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels as well. Yeah. And so there's a kind of movement, and there's some semblance of mobility with Caesar and with Cora. And really what he wants to do is just step away from those stereotypes, but he's just constantly pushed back into these identities that he doesn't want to be identified with anymore.
Well, as you say, I mean, Gulliver's Travels is obviously you have Gulliver travelling around from different societies and seeing things when he's in those. So this is there's a kind of a parallel there in what Cora and Caesar are doing, travelling through these different communities. Let's listen to a clip featuring Aaron Pierre as Caesar and Thussu Mbedu as Cora. He wants her basically to travel with him. He wants luck on his side, is how he puts it.
Indeed, yeah.
Cora, will you come with me? It is past time to go. There is nothing here but suffering. Pain and suffering.
You're wrong about me, Caesar. You think I'm some kind of luck because my mama got away, but you're wrong. You're wrong. I ain't no kind of look. The only kind I had was rotten. The kind that caused a woman to run away in the middle of the night and leave her only child. Leave her to bleed and rot on this damn plantation. Not the kind of luck you're looking for.
Pierre and Thussu Mbedu in a scene there from the Underground Railroad, the Amazon Prime adaptation of Colson Whitehead's novel. He's involved in this series, as I mentioned, Barry Jenkins. Barry Jenkins brings serious pedigree to this project, Jess.
Oh, it's so amazing. I mean, even the first couple of minutes is just unbelievable. You know, the imagery of it, the way it's presented to us. And, you know, straight away, you know, I was thinking like, you know, what time is this? You know, what's happening? Because there's almost this kind of like speeding into time and then this kind of backwards into time. There's this semblance of fantasy. There's moments where it's like, is this a dream or is this real? And it's wonderful. And he keeps you guessing throughout the whole thing. And as I said, you know, there's that kind of guessing of what is reality, what is fantasy. But then moments where it's the violence has to bring you back down to earth. And it's beautiful. And I think, you know, we kind of need that because, you know, we're faced with slavery, and it's an extremely harrowing and emotionally distressing thing to watch. But then these moments of fantasy gives us an idea of what's happening within the mindset of these people who are experiencing it. And what I loved as well, especially with Barry Jenkins and James Laxton, who's a cinematographer, there's these kind of moments of panning across some of the characters where there's a moment where we're kind of making eye contact with them. I don't know if you notice that so much when you're watching it, but you're kind of like, oh God, I'm immersed in this. I'm a part of this, you know? And I really, really loved that they did that, but it didn't take away from the the show too much. You know, there was just these brief moments where suddenly we were making eye contact with the character and then suddenly we were back into the story, and I love that.
The first episode deals with the pair of them, Caesar and Cora, on the Randall plantation. Yeah. And one of the brothers has died, and the one who's left, well, two was bad, but one is actually worse in this case. Benjamin Walker plays the character of Terence, the brother who survives. And here he is explaining how things will be done differently on the plantation now that his brother is dead.
Previously, my brother and I shared ownership of this fine land, like our great country, divided into north and south. Henceforth, there will be no north and south parcels. We will be one plantation, and I shall have say over all slaves who dwell here. If you wish, you may confer with your brethren from the southern plantation, but my brother and I have a very different approach to the conditioning and coordination of slaves. Accordingly, there will be no more parties. Wages earned in town on Sundays will be subject to a tariff. And to ensure the propagation of the best stock, I will personally oversee the pairing and practices in the ways of breeding. Too long, the best stock has been reserved for recreational and not vocational use. Some of you bucks ain't been living up to your billing.
Benjamin Walker there is Terence Randall in a scene from The Underground Railroad, the new Amazon Prime series that Jess Cavan is speaking to us about this evening. We got that line in the midst of that clip, Jess, the reference to Caesar's character, well, to several of the young men as being bucks. They are literally treated like livestock. That's how these people are being treated.
Oh, I mean, just listening to that again just makes my skin crawl, you know, and the words that are used, you know, these words like the conditioning of slavery. And, you know, I remember when I was watching it last night, you know, the words like reorganization, when we come to a community that have banned, you know, all black people. And, you know, the way that they've done that is essentially a form of genocide. And it's considered, you know, reorganization. And just the words that they use is just is so problematic in a way to kind of sheathe the level of violence that they're doing. It's really important to watch, but it's also very difficult. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, in as I said, you've seen it in more episodes than I have, I think, but I've only seen one, and the violence in that first episode.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I mean, there's one particular scene where there's a burning, a whipping, and a burning, and nothing, absolutely nothing, is left to the imagination in terms of that scene. And it's revisited several times. Do we need to have it as graphic as it is? Is that important, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's elements of it that feel, you know, as I said, it's the balance between the reality and the fantasy, I think, is really important. And the graphic element of how black people were treated at that time, And the hatred and the contempt that was directed towards them, I think it's important for that to be really looked at from a body perspective. And that's what we see. You know, we see these people being, you know, beaten and maimed and slaughtered. I think there's one instance where we actually see, as far as I'm aware, it's a skull's bridle. I don't know if you've heard of them before, but it's this kind of facial thing that you put on, used to be put on women, and it has like a prickly thing in the mouth so you can't scream or you can't talk. And like there's one of them, you know, within one of the moments, one of the scenes. And so I think it's really important to see that, and especially actually in relation to the script, because the script is written so wonderfully, and we really see how, you know, the white people at that time believed what they're doing was good. And so to listen to that kind of dialogue and to listen to that kind of rhetoric or so on, and then have that kind of juxtapose with what they truly were doing, I think that's super important.
Yeah, so we have on the one hand, we have these slave owners who are absolutely and totally believe that they have God and right on their side. But we also have another set of white people who are, if you like, the saviours of many of the slaves involved. What was your attitude to that particular portrayal?
It's so interesting. That particular episode really reminded me, kind of Jordan Peele, Get Out, that kind of vibe. And it also reminded me very much of a real person called J. Marion Sims, who's considered to be the father of gynecology. And he was lauded for many, many generations, but would have experimented unconsensually with black female slaves. And only very recently was, I think, one of his statues removed. And so there is these instances that occur where we think that these are the good ones. They're in a nice place and they're looked after and they're healthy and they're happy and they're allowed, express themselves and they're allowed to wear nice clothes and they seem safe, and it's presenting and portraying the safety. But underneath this sheath, there's something else kind of going on underneath that's super, super dark. And absolutely, and it's really important as well that it very much reflects, modern times, when you have this kind of the white do-gooder, the white saviour ideology, where, is what you do actually self-serving to your own ego, or is it actually kind of bettering somebody else's community? And that very much is a very extreme depiction of how that do-gooding kind of sense of self is not beneficial to anybody.
There's also another aspect here. We referred to how Caesar, in that scene that we heard with Benjamin Walker, as the slave owner, is referred to as one of the young bucks, one of the bucks, yeah, who isn't basically doing what they want him to do, which is breed. There are scenes then later into the series where, even though he's in inverted commas a much safer place and perhaps a place where he's more empowered, Caesar is similarly still kind of held up as some kind of specimen.
Yeah, he's called the Negro of the future, is the term that they use for him. And from my perspective of watching it, you're not 100% told what they're being given, but something is being given to these, young, strong black men, and they're being experimented on and they're being drugged and all of these different things. And the ones that are suffering, well, that's because they're from the past, and they're that disposable, whereas, we have Caesar, who is being kind of lauded as this because he can read and because he's intelligent and all that kind of stuff. But they also want to experiment on him and they want to research on him. And so once again, it's just another way of dehumanizing him. Mm. And it's just a recontextualization of that dehumanization.
You might tell me a little bit about the Joel Edgerton character, who appears towards the end of that first episode, but I get a sense that he's going to be with us for quite a part of the series. And I was unclear as to the nature of his character, to be honest.
Ridgeway. And Homer. Oh God. So the premise at Ridgeway is that he is a slave catcher, and he is as horrible as you can consider a slave catcher to be. But there is one really interesting episode, which is, I think, one of the shorter episodes, about 40 minutes long. And I will say that about the episodes as well. They're all about an hour long, and every one feels like this kind of epic film, which I loved. But we have a flashback to him. And, it's so sad to see that kind of conditioning and that kind of hatred just begin to kind of, solidify within his self, sense of self. And, he says something along the lines of, the reason why I do what I do is because black people, deserve to, people who have earned their freedom, the slaves who have absconded or escaped, they haven't earned their freedom. They haven't earned, their autonomy. And so that's the reason why, because, how dare they, And so there's always that thing of, like, humanity for black people needs to be earned, and that is the crux of him. And so, so I'm really looking forward to seeing something bad happen to him.
There are Irish immigrants involved in some of this part, the aspects of the story here in the Underground Railroad.
Yes.
How do we come out here? I fear.
So it's really interesting, and it reminds me a lot of Amadabari and Blind Boy. They've talked a lot about this, the way, and also with Carla, actually, is another great person who's talked about how the Irish have, how they navigated during this time, you know, because they were indentured servants, but at the same time they had whiteness, and so they had this opportunity for social mobility, and so they did end up in situations where they were, you know, extremely violent towards black people. And so that we are once again presented with this kind of vignette, this community of zealous Christians who have banned black people under horrendous circumstances. And so in order to have, you know, people to look after them, they replace black slaves with indentured Irish. And there's a huge amount of contempt and hatred for the Irish. And there's a term they use, the damned is the Irish, the N-word, the lepers and the insane. Mm. You know, and that's us, you know. And it's interesting though, yeah, that the oppression that the Irish are under, the indentured Irish, they have no empathy towards black people at all. We don't see that, but it is interesting to see how that power structure seems to not change, if you know what I mean.
Given I suppose recent events in the United States, and particularly Black Lives Matter movement, how do you think this series will be received, or has it been being received in America and to a wider audience, Jess?
I found the constant use of the N-word to be hard for me. Mm. I felt there was kind of like, I remember kind of writing the notes last night and being like, Quentin Tarantino level amount of N-word. Yeah, yeah. You know, and so that kind of made me a little bit uncomfortable. But then at the same time, we're also looking at it within the context of this time. And this is how black people were spoken about within the South. And so, you know, there's no way we can really shy away from that. I think Colson Whitehead is amazing. I read his recent book, The Nickel Boys, which is also a fantastic, fantastic novel. I do think it will be received well. But then, you know, I do think so. And Barry Jenkins, I mean, it's in the hands of this wonderful director, and also the composer Nicholas Brittle, I think, and James Laxton do such an incredible job. I hope it will be well received. And anybody who I've spoken about, who have said I'm reviewing this, are really excited to watch it. So I do hope it will be well received. And even an epic and a classic, I would go as far as say.
An epic and a classic. So you will definitely be watching the rest of it when you get it on your Amazon Prime on Friday
absolutely.
Night.
Absolutely. 100%, yeah.
Lovely, Jess. Thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Jess Cavan speaking to us about The Underground Railroad, and that will be available on Amazon Prime Video from this Friday evening. The RTE National Symphony Orchestra's live series of concerts continues this Friday when opera director, solo bassoonist and now conductor Peter Whelan takes over the baton to conduct a series of Mozart orchestral works and arias with soprano Aoife Miskelly. I'm delighted to be joined by Peter this evening, who's in Ireland ahead of his debut as conductor of the RTE National Symphony Orchestra. Peter, this is a funny one for you in many ways. You're no stranger to the world of opera, so Aoife Miskelly singing a series of arias, that's no big thing, I suppose, in some ways for you. Not, you know, it's nothing new. You're also no stranger to conducting an orchestra, the Irish Baroque Orchestra being one of the many. You're no stranger to the world of opera. You're no stranger to being a member of the NSO playing your bassoon, but this is the first time you've conducted the RTE NSO. What's that dynamic like for you?
Well, it's a very kind of special feeling, and it's always a bit tricky when you face, you know, ex-colleagues, like kind of poacher turned gameskeeper. But actually, it's been quite a while since I would have played in the orchestra, the NSO. I think I was a student, so maybe it's like 20 years ago, and I was called in as a very nervous student. I was doing music in Trinity at the time, and I was called in an emergency on a couple of occasions. But my teacher used to play there. Michael Jones was his name. And it's funny because you see these faces that you know from a long time ago. Of course, there's lots of different faces now, but like there's a lot of respect. Yeah. And it's a great honour, I suppose, been asked back.
Yeah, and Mozart, again, this is an area that you're no stranger to, the music of Mozart. But I love the overture that will start the concert out. If ever there was an overture made for a concert where you were going to have some operatic arias, this is the overture, isn't it?
Yeah, I absolutely love this overture, the Impresario. So it's written about the same time as Marriage of Figaro, so it's full of that kind of subversive energy. And it's all about different kinds of, you know, divas fighting it out with each other. It's a very short little work, but it doesn't get played all that often. I think it's just a nice kind of fizzy way to start off proceedings. Not to say for a moment now that Aoife Miskelly is Aoife herself. In fact, I know that she's been putting in the during the lockdown, she's been dishing out vaccines. So she's been putting herself... Very good use indeed, yeah.
And I suppose the story that's told in that overture, it literally is each instrument or certain of the instruments are basically given diva-like characters to fight with the others.
There's some very sharp elbows between the winds and the strings, and it's also just sets the scene really well. It reminds me of those two guys in the Muppet Show, kind of Waldorf and Stadler, looking down and kind of like licking their lips in anticipation of all of these divas trashing around the stage. Yeah.
But that is by way of setting us up in some ways for the Symphony No. 39 in E flat major that you will also be conducting. What's involved here?
Well, it's one of Mozart's final three symphonies. It's maybe the least performed of the final three, but it is very well known. And I suppose the thinking behind it this time around is just it's a very healthy and kind of healing music. You know, it's just not to say that it's easy music. It takes a lot of... we know that Mozart spent a lot of time trying to get it just right, but it's very he's such a considerate and warm composer. Like you're always a better person coming out of listening to the symphony than you were going in. Like that's an important aspect for Mozart. You know that you're the kind of classical lines, the symmetry kind of sorts out your own thoughts and feelings, so that somehow it benefits the world. And even the first movements in a kind of a 3-4, which is a dancey, lilty kind of vibe, which also kind of puts the world to write as well. So I just thought, yeah, in this very tricky time, especially for musicians, you know, and we miss our audience terribly at this point. And I hope it's the other way around too. And it's just, I suppose a little kind of love song to each other.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, we often hear this idea that, you know, if you play Mozart to the child in the womb, that they'll have this great sense of classical structure in their brain, or even Bach, whatever, you know, that they'll have a great sense of structure. So what you're saying to anybody who's feeling a little bit frazzled on this Monday evening, that perhaps listening to a little bit of the opening section of the Minuet movement here might sort things out for them. Let's try. The opening section there of the third movement, the Minuet movement from Mozart's Symphony No. 39 in E flat major, and that is one of the pieces that the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra will be playing this coming Friday evening as part of the live series. Peter Whelan will be conducting the production. The recording we just heard, by the way, has the Freiburger Baroque Orchestra conducted by René Jacobs. But Peter, listening to that, it really has a sense of buoyancy in it, doesn't it? In a way that perhaps it could lift the mood at the moment. And today is a good day, let's face it. Lots of opening ups happening. And hopefully that will translate into concert halls, etc. later in the summer, as we've been promised. But there is a real sense of uplift and buoyancy there.
Well, I hope so. And like I was saying, it's such an effervescent symphony, and it is just feel-good music. And at the same time, it's something that can really can heal as well. And as I was saying, we hope we're slowly getting back to some kind of normality. I live over in London for the most part at the moment, and there's some concerts with real life audiences coming back. So it's definitely in the air. So hopefully that'll kind of continue in the same.
Yeah, if you're a bit further down the line then, have you had a situation in London or anywhere in England where you've been able to perform with live audience at this point?
Well, you know what? It just as soon as I go back, I have maybe a couple of weeks, and then I'll be into the into the Wigmore Hall, and we're doing a very a small concert there with two singers, and there'll be I think six of us in total on stage, And that's going to be one of the very first concerts that they're opening up again. So there'll be a very small audience invited to that. So it's kind of they're testing the waters. And of course, taking all of the precautions and all the rest. That's John Gill Hooley, a great Irish man from Limerick, and he's always doing wonderful stuff. He's kind of a trailblazer in lots of respects, with you know pushing forward to try and get music back live again. And then it does seem to continue that way for the rest of the summer. More and more things seem to open. But then, of course, you look into different countries in Europe, like France, for instance, and it seems to be slowing down. So it's just a matter of where you look. But the only thing we can do is to stay optimistic.
Yeah, well, we heard Minister Catherine Martin today speaking about the possibility of theatres and cinemas opening up possibly next month. And you would think if it's happening in theatres and cinemas, concert halls won't be too far behind, one would hope. But I guess it all has to be done safely, as you said. Now, Aoife Miss Kelly, as I said, the soprano, you have worked with Aoife in the Irish National Opera's first production, in fact, The Marriage of Figaro. The music of Mozart involved there. Again, so this is a nice chance to reacquaint yourselves with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't believe it's 2018. That was the first INO production, I think, and we did Figaro in down in Wexford in the Gaiety. And Aoife was it's the first time I met Aoife, and she was singing the role of Cherubino, and she did such an amazing job. She's got huge eyes, and again it's another trouser role. Just couldn't keep your eyes off her. Just amazing actress, and all of the roles she'll be singing with on Friday are three very different, this time female characters, but she's just such a genius at portraying them all. The three arias we're doing are very similar, very concise, an economic writing from Mozart. It's the exact same key, exact same instrumentation, but three incredibly different characterizations of women.
Yeah, you would have thought he always has an eye to the possible concert after the event, even in doing that. Tell me a little bit then about which of the three women are we getting in Act 4 in De Vieni Non Tarda, that aria?
So that is from Figaro, and that's Susanna the maid. And she's been relentlessly pursued by the lecherous count. And she uses this opportunity to make her husband, who's listening on Figaro, to make him jealous. So she's been quite duplicitous in this absolutely ravishing and very kind of sexy aria.
All right. And the version we have here has the Alison Hagley is the singer. So a little flavour there of De Vieni Non Tarda from Act 4 of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, which one of the arias which Aoife Miss Kelly will be singing in Friday night's concert with the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra in the live series. Peter Whelan conducting on the evening is with me this evening. Just going back to you and your bassoon playing, Peter, I'm just thinking of the poor woodwinds, particularly there in an aria like that, and often in a Mozart aria where it's delicate and the voice is allowed to sit up on above the orchestra. It's the woodwinds that you'll be glaring down at.
Yeah, I mean, I think playing the woodwind parts for Mozart are always an absolute gift. They fit in the instrument beautifully, and he's always writing for his friends. You know, sometimes in the concertos that he writes for woodwinds, he's writing very rude remarks to the wind players as they're playing. And sometimes it's at their expense, but he's definitely, this particular piece is an absolute joy. I actually remember recording it. I was playing in the orchestra for Simon Rattle once to drop a name, but I remember his wife was singing the solo role. And just in the middle of this very aria, there's just one very long, unpromising looking note on the bassoon. And I remember he just stopped the rehearsal and said, this has to be the sexiest note that bassoon has ever played. And it's just a middle C for about like a 20 seconds. But I'll always remember that. But
and he did you have to play that note after Simon Rattle stops the entire orchestra and says, okay, Peter, you're about to play the sexiest note ever written by Mozart. One, two,
no
three,
pressure.
Go.
Yeah, it was a little bit like that. Yeah, and then of course the red lights on. I think it was in an Abbey Road or one of those studios too. But that's all part of the game, I suppose. It doesn't take much. I think Mozart provides so much of the material. You just have to kind of just tune into where he's coming from, and it's all there.
I wish you had your bassoon and I could say, well, let me hear what the sexiest note that Mozart wrote sounds like, please, Peter. But you don't. You have the baton. Best of luck with Friday evening's performance, Peter, and great to speak with you this evening.
Thanks so much.
Peter Whelan there, and the RTE National Symphony Orchestra with conductors Peter Whelan and Killian Farrell, and soprano Aoife Miss Kelly will be streamed, live streamed from the National Concert Hall on Friday, May the 14th. RTE.ie/culture will get you that, or it's broadcast live on RTE Lyric FM. Poetry Speaks, Poems and Moving Image is a new exhibition of films and spoken poetry comprising an installation of film performances which will be shown in the Irish Museum of Modern Art's Formal Gardens. A total of 33 films feature celebrated contemporary poets reading their own work along with beloved classics. The films were put together by Irish filmmaker Matthew Thompson with music by Jerry Horn and Sean Carpio. Here poet Sean Hewitt reads the poem Queens by J.M. Singh.
7 dog days we let pass, naming queens in Glen McNass. All the rare and royal names wormy sheepskin yet retains. Ethan, Helen, Maeve and Fand, golden Deirdre's tender hand. Bert, the Bigfoot sung by Vion, Cassandra Ronsar found in Leon. Queens of Sheba, Meath and Connacht, quaff with crown or gaudy bonnet. Queens whose finger once did stir men. Queens were eaten of fleas and vermin. Queens men drew like Mona Lisa or slew with drugs in Rome and Pisa. We named Lucrezia Crivelli and Titian's lady with amber belly. Queens acquainted in learned sin, Jane of Jewry's slender shin, queens who cut the bogs at Glanna, Judith of Scripture and Gloriana, queens who wasted the East by proxy, or drove the ass cart, the tinker's doxy. Yet these are rotten, I ask their pardon, and weave the sun on rock and garden. These are rotten, so you're the queen of all our living, or have been.
Poet Sean Hewitt there reading the J.M. Singh poem Queens, and it's the audio from a film there which is part of an exhibition which was launched at the Irish Museum of Modern Art in Dublin, which is, if you could hear background noise, that's because it is part of that film. You can find out full details on Imma, imma.ie, or brinkerhoffpoetry.org. Now, Kalyaka, The Age of Reason, Unreason, is an exhibition by a collective of 8 older women, all based in Ireland, but coming from Holland, England and Switzerland, as well as Ireland. Many of you listening, of course, will know that Na Cailleacha translates as the witches, and it's the name that the group took upon themselves, having come together at an arts foundation in County Mayo last year. And the exhibition comprises work they have developed since that time in Mayo, and it's just opened at the South Tipperary Arts Centre in Clonmel. It's launched to coincide with a Bialtaine Festival. It's curated by artist Catherine Marshall, who's also a contributor to Na Cailleacha, and delighted to have Catherine join me this evening. Catherine, just bring me back to the 8 of you together at this. Where exactly were you in Mayo? Ballinglen, where were you there, and what was going on?
We were in the Ballinglen Arts Foundation, which is a residency programme. I think they can accommodate about 10 artists or 12 artists at a time, and the 8 of us decided that we would like to do a residency together. So we went to Ballinglen, and we hadn't all met for the first time until we arrived there, but we very quickly established how we might work together and what our common interests were, and within sort of 24 hours we had become a fairly cohesive group.
Yeah, I just wondered about how the 8 of you kind of happened upon each other, if you like, in some ways, and then decided, let's all go on this residency together.
Yeah, it wasn't quite that haphazard. one of the artists was about to have a 75th birthday and thought she would get a group of 8 women together. She chose the number 8 as a symbolic number that symbolised a female shape in some way. And so that was one idea. And she and 2 very good old friends, so Helen Comerford was the birthday person, and Terry Rudin and Patricia Hurl, who were old friends, decided that they had always anyway wanted to work with a bunch of women and maybe just do one work. But they asked me to join them, and then we invited the other 4 people. But we hadn't all met each of the other 4. And we decided that Ballantlen, if it was available, would be a good place to go to, especially because we couldn't leave Ireland to go anywhere else. So we went to Ballantlen, and we were lucky. We managed to be there in between lockdowns last September, and we were all coming out of bubbles. So we were able to make a bubble and work together very well.
And work in a normal fashion, seeing as you had created your own bubble. Now, you mentioned Terry, Patricia, Helen and yourself were the initial 4. So give us the other 4 so that we can complete the picture for ourselves.
So the other 4 were Gerda Tellier, who's Dutch, based in Wexford. Maria Levinge, who is also based in Wexford. And Carol Nelson, who's a musician and jazz player, composer and jazz player, who now lives in Carlow but is from England. And Barbara Freeman, who is the oldest of us all and lives in Belfast.
So we have 6 artists, essentially, 1 musician and then yourself as the art writer and curator in the midst of all of this. Now, Nakalyaka, I mean, it's too easy to translate it in some ways as the witches, because there's a sense of power really in that word Kalyach as well as everything else, isn't there?
There is, and we're very conscious of that and want to make sure that we don't lose sight of that, but we're also very conscious of the negative as well as the positive things that are said and thought about older women and about witches, about lack of visibility, about just being a bit of a nuisance in the neighbourhood, maybe being demanding and not giving much in return and so on. And we just wanted to look at all of the stereotypes and throw them up in the air and see where they landed.
What we see then in the exhibition, was it all created during that residency in Ballinglen?
It was all begun during that residency. So Terry Rudin started to make a documentary film about the whole process from beginning to end. And that included studio work that she found us all doing, but also, you know, we had these sort of curated discussions in the evenings after dinner where we'd set a topic for ourselves about things that concerned us, like visibility, like isolation, like loss of friendships as we get older and friends die or, you know, move away, or we lose them for one reason or another. And how do you create new friends when you're over 70? We look at lack of energy, loss of memory, all of those things, and, you know, try to find some strategies for making them positive sources of inspiration, you know.
Terry gives us the documentary film Dawn to Dusk, which effectively shows us what happened over that period of the residency. Then Helen has responded with abstract paintings.
Yes, Helen had been making abstract paintings for many years, and at the same time exploring the place of women in mythology and in Irish life. So she's just completed a series of paintings, begun in Ballinglen but completed now. There are 19 in all of them, but we just show 2 in this show. And then Patricia Hurl had been a painter and somebody who really, I suppose, hit the ground running in the 1980s, making very feminist work, but then turned to performance work in the last couple of decades. So when she came to Ballinglen, I think she thought she would continue to make performance work, but instead found herself lured back into painting and proved that she's a natural painter.
Do we get a performance work that involves all 8 of you, in fact, as well?
Yes, you do. You do indeed. This grew out of us, out of our discussions in the evenings and our talk about the landscape in Northwest Mayo. You know, we're right out near the Cage of Fields with the Atlantic, you know, lashing against the cliffs all around us. So there were sounds in the landscape. There was the geology, which is very visible up there. And there was us and our, you know, skin that's getting older and lined and wrinkled a bit like the landscape itself. And so we started to make work that had to do with tuning into nature and ourselves feeling very much a part of nature. And we made a performance piece together called Stone Sounding.
Lots of references within that to the body and, in fact, to the skin. And Barbara Freeman and Carol Nelson have actually, they have a piece called Skin. What's involved there?
It's photographs. Barbara went out and photographed pieces of the landscape that she felt had gave her a particular insight into how the earth was structured, and that the earth was young and the earth was middle-aged and the earth was old, as indeed are we. And she juxtaposed photographs from that landscape with photographs of, you know, of aging skin, and made a sort of interlayering of them, which is very beautiful. And that was accompanied by sounds recorded by herself and some of Carol's composition, all working together to make a beautiful piece, actually.
And what then do Gerda Tellier and Maria Levinge give us?
Gerda did this wonderful, very large line drawing. It's over 2 metres wide by 1.5 metres high, and it was just one big continuous piece where she drew with a thin blue line all the time for nearly 4 weeks, never losing the pace of it or the energy or the rhythm. In fact, hopping from one chair to another across 4 chairs so that her hand didn't lose its place.
Wow.
Or break the rhythm. It's about infinity, really, and posterity.
And I guess that fits in with your figure eight as well. If you put the eight on its side, you get the infinity as well, don't you? And Maria?
And Maria had been, her practice is to paint landscapes and gardens and quite sort of domesticated landscape. But she's been very drawn to North Mayo herself and to the bogs and, you know, the terrain up there. But on this occasion, she started to make ink derived from bog oak and oak gall. So she did these beautiful experimental drawings in oak gall. It had been used by Rembrandt, but, you know, she found a recipe for it and made her own.
Right. And then, Catherine, you were part of the print portfolio and, of course, the performance, as you mentioned, in the wilds of the Cliffs of Mayo.
But don't hold out for my performance. That won't do much good for anybody.
The big part for you will be the part of this, the upcoming The Age of Reason on Reason symposium on May the 29th.
Yes. Yes.
What's there? Just give me a brief summary of what we'll get.
We're going to fuse the things that I suppose we had been foremost in our minds when we were together in Mayo, which is health and mortality. So Professor Roseanne Kenny, who is the head of the School of Gerontology in Trinity, will be the keynote speaker. We will have the poet and writer Grace Wells talking about the place of woman in the older woman in literature and mythology, particularly Irish mythology. Then we'll have the eight of us talking about our practice and our sort of theory and discussions about it. And we will wrap up with a theatre producer and director from the next generation, Maeve Lambert, who will respond as a younger person.
All right. Well, lots to interest everybody there, I would have thought. Nacalica, The Age of Reason on Reason, open at the South Tipperary Arts Centre. And, of course, the southtiparts.ie will give you details about the symposium on May 29th. Now, last month we spoke to the wonderful actor Denise Goff, getting major plaudits for her performance in the TV drama Too Close on ITV. That drama starts tonight on Virgin Media One, so you can watch it here in Ireland as well, 9 p.m. this evening. But that's our lot for this Monday on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tom Norton was in sound this evening. Tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night, once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.